Well, thanks very much. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers. I'd like to begin by thanking Lillian and Tanisha. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm honored to have been invited to speak here, and also all the other organizers and volunteers. I know it takes a lot of energy to put together events like that, so I really want to thank everybody and just say that I really appreciate it. I also want to, sort of point out again that International Women's Day is a really important time for women everywhere to celebrate the successes, because we have had successes. But I think that also it's really important to recommit ourselves to the really tough job of realizing women's liberation. And I think it's an important day for us to really, recommit ourselves to that. The struggle has certainly got much, much harder now, and I think that's why this sort of recommitment is really needed, very necessary, vital right now, not only for women's liberation, but really if this planet is to be saved. So I just want to, stress the importance of this day and the important meaning that it has in women's lives everywhere. So I also want to say before I begin my talk that the talk that I'm going to present today is really based on my work, my organizing, and my research in what we call the rest of Canada, outside Quebec. So I just want to point out that what I'm saying here, might not be the same in Quebec, that the situation, could well be very, very different. And there are many of you who are doing research in the same areas in Quebec. So, I look forward to having a discussion afterwards and look at what might be some of the differences and similarities. So my talk really today is about the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, and the ensuing war on terrorism, which sparked a strong public anti-Islamic sentiment in Canada, as was the case in the United States, in Europe, and many other parts of the world. Muslims and those who look like Muslims, basically black and brown bodies, came to be viewed with suspicion and hostility. And Muslim organizations, as well as other people of color organizations across the country in Canada, reported increased attacks on their communities, popularly defined as a backlash, even though the National Post had a big debate about whether there really was a backlash or not. But popularly defined as a backlash in response to 9/11, the security-conscious anti-Islamic sentiment has not abated in the years since the attack. In fact, it has gotten much stronger. So what I want to do tonight is look at the impact of the war on terrorism on notions of the enemy, but also at the same time on notions of how Canadian nationhood has been redefined since the events of 9/11 and in the war on terrorism. And I want to look at the citizenship rights of people of color and what some of the feminist responses have been to these events. So immediately following the attacks of 9/11, the Liberal government in Canada, following the lead of the Bush administration, implemented a number of major policy changes in the name of fighting terrorism. These included the strengthening of state powers of surveillance and detention, the imposition of greater restrictions on immigration and refugee policies, the increased scrutiny of immigrants and refugees, both at the borders and within the country, and a strengthening of the powers of deportation, a commitment to fight the war on terrorism under the leadership of the Bush administration, more specifically to participate in the war on Afghanistan. It also led to the intensification of intelligence, security, and military alliances with the United States. These measures constituted Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as the international enemy of the United States and its allies, like Canada. And internally, they pointed in North America to the figure of the Muslim immigrant and refugee as the greatest threat to national security. Not only was the figure of the immigrant and refugee being recast as the Muslim outsider through such measures, with his or her essential and immutable civilizational inferiority, so was the Canadian nation being recast now enthusiastically remembering its identity as part of the community of the West, also with its attendant racialized claims to civilizational superiority. This idea of recasting the West is very important for me to think through and what that means, because of course in Canada, since the 1970s, the nation has presented itself on the global stage as a multicultural nation. And, you know, tepid and hollow as the changes were, and a number of scholars have written about multiculturalism as still contributing to the maintenance of sort of white supremacy in this country. Nevertheless, multiculturalism did, compel the nation to position itself somewhat differently. Since 9/11, I think the self-identification, the self-representation of the nation as multicultural has come under intense attack. So recasting the West for me is a very important thing to look at in what's happening to how Canadian nationhood is being redefined. The Bush administration, of course, informed the world that the immediate cause of the 9/11 attacks was the murderous envy of the Islamists of the democracy and freedoms that abound in the civilized West. And this knowledge quickly became the frame for representing the war on terrorism. The evildoers hate our freedoms was the explanation offered and readily repeated by Canadian political and media elites to questions about why the attacks had occurred. The claim that there exists an abundance of democracy and freedoms in the West and that these are the real targets of the terrorists rapidly became part of the common sense understandings widely articulated in the public sphere. We are civilized and free. They are filled with hate and envy for us. Western civilization here in this recasting of Canadian nationhood is exalted as superior, as are Western values and culture, while Islamic civilization and culture are denigrated as pre-modern, barbaric, and inherently violent. Best encapsulated in Samuel Huntington's thesis of The Clash of Civilizations, this narrative posits the two as inherently antithetical and irreconcilable. As others have noted, this clash of cultures thesis serves to mask the long-term commitments and underlying interests of the United States in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern and Central Asian countries. As Mahmoud Mamdani has noted in his new book, this culture talk avoids history and politics and downplays the crucial encounter with colonial power, which shapes the relationship of the United States to the Middle East and Central Asia in the current geopolitical order. For Mamdani, taking this history and politics into account means recognizing that militant Islamist movements are the outcome of contemporary political realities, such as the Cold War hostilities between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the CIA's support for the revival of the concept of armed jihad through its alliances with various Mujahideen factions in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. The consequences of colonial and imperialist domination and the Third World's contestation of the geopolitical order is a more accurate frame for understanding the current international conflict, Mamdani argues. And as for the concept of the West, Stuart Hall has pointed out that ideas about the West and the East do not refer principally to geography, but are part of a system of representation that is rooted in the myths and fantastical projections of Europeans and in their historical conquest of territories and colonization of peoples. Whereas the discourse of the West and the rest treats the development of the West as the result of forces largely internal to Europe's history and formation, Hall argues that this development was instead very much a global story. It was in relation to and in contrast to the rest that the West developed its own sense of identity, just as it was in relation to the wealth of its colonies that Europe and Euro-America were able to develop their own economies. In the case of Canada, the ongoing colonization of Aboriginal peoples and their dispossession remains the foundations for Canadian nationhood. The resurgence of this discourse of the West in the post-9/11 era has enabled all those who are hailed as members of the Canadian nation to assert their own individual claims to civilizational superiority in relation to the nation's others, the most obvious danger of the resurgence of this discourse is that it again erases the reality of Aboriginal presence in North America long before the arrival of the West, as it does the ongoing subjugation and resistance of Aboriginal peoples in the ongoing development of the West on this continent. The concept of the West is also deeply gendered, and you know, it has been used to present the war on terror as a war to liberate women. The concept of the West is a deeply gendered concept, as the status of women has historically served as a crucial signifier of the modernity of the West against the purported traditionality of the rest. In its relations with the West has historically claimed to subscribe to the value of gender equality, to preferring greater freedoms and rights to women, even as European women, including Euro-Canadian women, continue to be subjugated to patriarchal control and oppression. As many anti-racist feminists have argued, the West continues to be popularly presented as a site for democratic rights and freedoms for women, as committed to their equal integration into public life, and as this being a cherished value of the West. The non-West, on the other hand, has been imagined as a site of terrible oppression and violence for women, where practices such as forced marriages, dowry deaths, honor killings, and female genital mutilation are said to routinely characterize the lives of all women. Notwithstanding the reality of patriarchal relations within Western societies, including Canada, European powers nevertheless used patriarchal relations within non-Western countries to justify their conquest and colonization of these countries. Drawing upon these older Orientalist and gendered tropes, the war on terror dramatically interjected gender into the center of global political debates as the Bush administration identified the liberation of Afghan women as a key policy objective in its war on Afghanistan. Canadian media and politicians, as was the case in the United States, used this rationale, and the media became replete with images of veiled Afghan and other Muslim women and girls who acquired an unprecedented public visibility. However, this heightened visibility was primarily used to silence critics of U.S. foreign policy. Much of the news reporting, for instance, focused on the banning of Afghan women from public life by the Taliban regime, reducing this to the unchanging and timeless practices of all Islamic cultures, and thereby using it as a rationale which necessitated the West's intervention. Although individual women, such as Dr. Seema Samar, were lauded for their personal bravery in challenging the Taliban's gender dictates, these women were treated as exceptional. Feminists such as her were treated as exceptional. The image of the veiled woman as the icon of victimized and passive Muslim womanhood overwhelmed all other images and representations. Notably absent from mainstream public debate was the impact of U.S. bombings on Afghan women, on Iraqi women subsequently, of the civilian casualties, and of the opposition of women's groups in those countries to the war. Additionally, no space was allowed to address the impact of colonialist and imperialist practices on Muslim women's oppression, or to address this oppression in political economic terms. This could only be addressed in terms of the backward cultural practices of Muslims and their medieval civilizational values. In the nation's fantasies, then, Muslims became constituted as either good or bad Muslims. The good Muslims were the assimilated ones. They acquiesced to U.S. imperial interests, vociferously defend these interests, and they know their proper place as supplicants. They are appropriately grateful to the West for having allowed them to partake in its civilizational project, and they want to aid the West in its quest to liberate their co-religionists around the world. Such a strategy of dividing the good natives from the bad has a long history in Canada, dating from the period when noble savages were distinguished from the violent savages among Aboriginal peoples. The construct of the violent savage was used to justify the genocidal violence unleashed on Aboriginal peoples, that of the noble savage used to make a case for their assimilation and cultural extinction. In the era of the war on terrorism, the good Muslim woman is the one who will propagate Western gender and sexual norms while berating her co-religionists, both women and men, for refusing to laud the magnanimity of the West towards Muslim women. This Muslim woman needs to be rescued from her culture and religion, protected from the men in her family and community. This Muslim woman can be redeemed. She can be brought into the embrace of civilization. The quintessential image of this good Muslim woman in the initial stages of the war on terror was the burqa-clad Afghan woman, victim and voiceless. However, subsequent significant space was also given to the bad Muslim woman in public discussions. She is the woman who dares to defy Western gender norms, who chooses to reject them, who refuses to condemn her religion and its adherents. This is the woman who is not imperiled, but who imperils the West by her embrace of Islam or by her resistance to colonial occupation and imperialist aggression. This is the black widow of Chechnya, the suicide bomber of Palestine, the Dr. Germ and Mrs. Anthrax of Iraq. This Muslim woman is not to be rescued. She is irredeemable. Indeed, she has to be annihilated along with her male cohorts. The worst of these women are the ones who refuse to unveil themselves, who insist on wearing their scarves, burqas, chadors, and hijabs. A photograph, and I'm really sorry, I meant to bring these images with me, but I've forgotten them in an office somewhere. But a photograph of a crowd of chador-clad women holding signs which read, "Islam, yes, secular, no." This was a demonstration against the banning of the hijab in France, appeared in the Globe and Mail, accompanied by the headline, "The West and the Worst." These women, these kinds of images have become ubiquitous. If you just look at the newspapers, anywhere, we're just surrounded by these images. These women who reject Western notions of secularism are labeled the worst. They contest the dominant representations of the Bush administration as quasi-feminist. They reject this administration's claims to be liberating Muslim women through a war with imperialist designs. In their embrace of Islam, they also challenge the deeply embedded ideas of Western superiority by seemingly rejecting the freedoms in the form that they are enjoyed by Western women. In Canada, the presence of women of color has been a site of considerable anxiety since the nation's foundation. Women's bodies, as the markers of racial, cultural, and national difference, continue to be constructed as primarily responsible for transmitting cultural difference onto subsequent generations. Media representations attest to the national anxiety regarding these women's commensurability with national values and practices in their invariable narrations of the cultural deficiency which is said to shape these women's lives. News reports of these women largely focus on them as victims of what Uma Narayan has fittingly termed death by culture. As discussed above, the violence in these women's lives is neatly reduced to their inherent cultural traits, and the Canadian nation is popularly presented as a site that affords them escape from their families and communities and gender liberation. Not surprisingly, then, Muslim women have become the cause for particular consternation since 9/11, their bodies the sites for the waging of the clash of cultures. The adoption by these women of Western values, of Western dress and Western lifestyle lends legitimacy to the nation's claims to civilizational superiority as marked by its liberalized gender norms. The Muslim woman's modernization, signaled by the level of her assimilation, upholds such claims. However, should she lapse into her cultural and traditional ways by, for example, adopting the wearing of the headscarf or the burqa or chador, the superiority and alleged universality of the nation's values are threatened. If assimilation occurs successfully, then her difference can be contained. It's what Stuart Hall called the difference that makes no difference. Indeed, it can be used to further exalt the West. No matter, however, how deep the gratitude of the good Muslim, the post-9/11 anti-terrorism measures adhere to no such distinctions between the good ones and the bad Muslims. All are equally suspect. The new publicly sanctioned racial profiling and other anti-terrorist measures recognize no fine distinctions between good and bad Muslims. The citizenship rights of all those who look like Muslims are currently under attack. And I think that this is a very serious moment for people of color in this country, because the citizenship rights of all people of color have been severely eroded since 9/11. A former Canadian ambassador claimed publicly that the security of both countries, the United States and Canada, remains vulnerable to a Canadian asylum system that seems designed to openly welcome potential terrorists. Post-9/11, immigration and refugee laws were popularly presented as having made Canada a terrorist haven, second only to U.S. for terrorist infiltration. One newspaper reported, I'm quoting, "Although none of the terrorists came from Canada, the existence of terrorist cells has been well documented. The threat continues today. Not only Muslims and those who look like them, black and brown people, became suspect, but I want to argue that all immigrants and refugees have become suspect, as high-ranking public officials routinely voice fears about the country having already been infiltrated by terrorists through its lax immigration and refugee policies. In addition to placing border control guards on high security alert, hundreds, if not thousands, of immigrants and refugees were rounded up for detention in Canada following the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., as was the case in the United States and in Europe, under allegations of being security threats. The terrorist threat has come to be seen now is emanating not only from those who were outside the country's geographical borders and who might seek to enter the country, but is emanating also from immigrants already in the country. Indeed, as the term sleeper cells entered into the popular lexicon, the panic created by its deployment meant that people of color who might have lived their entire lives in Canada also became suspect. Sleeper cells might remain dormant for up to 20 years, some experts claimed, thus extending suspicion to most immigrants who have entered the country in large numbers since the liberalization of immigration and citizenship legislation in the 1970s. The scenario suggested, again, quite routinely and commonly by these experts, is that immigrants came to Canada over the last 20 years not to make a better life for themselves and their families, but that they premeditated their entry for the purposes of committing mass murder 20 to 30 years hence. The central contradiction of Canadian citizenship, deeply rooted in its earliest stages of development, is that citizenship rights in this country remain based in the colonial institution of white supremacy, originating in the exclusion of Aboriginal peoples and denied for almost a century to most people of color. Here, the category citizen emerged not through some internal process within a natural community as part of the liberal project of greater freedom and greater progress as promised by modernization, but this category emerged in the very act of transforming indigenous insiders into outsiders and aliens within their own territories, while simultaneously turning outsiders, colonizers, settlers, and immigrants into insiders, i.e. Canadian citizens. The category citizen, born in the genocidal violence of colonization, exists in a dialectical relation with its other, the Indian, for whom the emergence of this citizenship has been deadly, not emancipatory. This institution of citizenship was key to the process of settlement and nation formation. It organized and formalized colonial dispossession through the granting of rights to domicile and land ownership, even as it gave meaning concretely to the category Indian, primarily as lac. colonial settlement, access to land, and the development of the market economy relied upon the extension of citizenship rights to settlers and immigrants. As these rights were invested in the institution of citizenship, the institution itself became inseparable from the forced internal migration of Aboriginal peoples onto reservations, the suppression of their sovereignty, and their ongoing dispossession. Further, formal access to all non-Aboriginal populations was organized through migration or by birth within national borders. If a major condition for the founding of the Canadian nation state was the acquisition of a national territory, no less important was the recruitment and management of a national population, for which the state turned mainly to European countries until well into the 20th century. Immigration policy has thus been of signal importance in the process of generating a national population and in regulating access to formal citizenship. From Confederation until the 60s and 1970s, immigration and naturalization legislation distinguished first British and French and subsequently other Europeans as preferred races for integration into the nation. In the exaltation of this status for over a century after Confederation, the state constructed and solidified in an essentialized absolute manner racial identity as political identity, shaping the nation's self-definition and symbolic identity, as well as its legal citizenship, as white. Canadian citizenship was instituted, therefore, in a triangulated formation. The Aboriginal, marked for physical and cultural extinction, deserving of citizenship only upon abdication of their Aboriginality. The preferred race settler and immigrant, exalted as worthy of citizenship and membership in the nation, and the non-preferred race immigrant, marked as a stranger and sojourner, an unwelcome intruder whose lack of Christian faith, inherent deviant tendencies, and unchecked fecundity had to be carefully monitored. Although people of color have had significantly greater access to citizenship since the liberalization of immigration and citizenship legislation in the 1960s and 1970s. And these gains, I want to underscore that they have been extremely significant for people of color in extending access to family reunification, which means basically the right to live with your family. They have had, you know, they have been a significant gain for people of color in this country, but they still subjected to people of color to a second-class citizenship status. The symbolic inscription of white subjects as essentially legitimate citizens with proprietorial claims to state protection and national resources, and immigrants as racial and cultural outsiders to the nation, was not transformed by this liberalizing period of the 1970s. As many scholars have noted, I want to give you some names, Himani Banerjee, Shirin Razak, Roxana Ng, Tanya Das Gupta, Inakshi Dua, Sadef Arad Koch, they have all argued that the interpolation of preferred race subjects constituted citizenship as white in the national and international imagination, and that the politics of multiculturalism did not fundamentally challenge this, but rather contributed to the maintenance of this particular self-representation on the global stage. I think it's very important to understand that the history of citizenship in Canada teaches special lessons to people of color. The lesson of the early immigration policies before the 1960s taught people of color that having the same legal status, i.e., that of British subjects, for South Asians, for example, was not enough to ensure their legal access to citizenship. South Asian migrants to Canada until the mid-20th century had this status of British subjects, which they shared with British subjects who lived in Britain, i.e. who were white, not to ignore the fact that there has been a significant black presence in Britain during that time as well. But South Asian migrants at that time shared the same legal status of British subjects within the British Empire, but they were not allowed the same mobility rights or domicile in Canada through immigration policy. The internment of Japanese Canadians reinforced that lesson for people of color. It should be remembered that many Japanese Canadians who were interned and even deported had their property confiscated. Many of them were actually natural-born Canadian citizens. However, their racial identity trumped their political identity as citizens. This is a lesson that people of color cannot afford to forget in this moment of crisis. In October 2002, the United States announced that individuals traveling into the U.S. from countries, including Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan, among others, were to be photographed and fingerprinted at the borders. The new rules were to apply also to Canadian citizens born in these particular countries. These technologies of surveillance are symbolically associated with criminality, and their application to these particular bodies in transit constitutes these bodies as potentially criminal. Dubbing the application of such technologies to travelers to the United States biopolitical tattooing, the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben publicly canceled his own travel plans to the United States and called for others to likewise oppose the normalization of these technologies. And I want to quote Agamben here. "Some years ago, I had written that the West's political paradigm was no longer the city-state, but the concentration camp, and that we had passed from Athens to Auschwitz. It was obviously a philosophical thesis and not historical recital, because one could not confuse phenomenon that is, it is proper, on the contrary, to distinguish. I would have liked to suggest that the tattooing at Auschwitz undoubtedly seemed the most normal and economic way to regulate the enrollment and registration of deported persons into concentration camps. The biopolitical tattooing the United States imposes now to enter its territory could well be the precursor to what we will be asked to accept later as the normal identity registration of a good citizen in the state's gears and mechanisms." This is Giorgio Agamben. Agamben raises the alarm that such technologies of surveillance are first introduced in relation to the dangers posed by foreigners and then subsequently applied to citizens on a routine basis. Well, they are today widely being applied to citizens, to those who look like Muslim, whether they are citizens or non-citizens alike. It's a pity that Agamben doesn't take race into consideration in his analysis of the current situation. The association of these particular technologies of surveillance with the form of the 9/11 attacks, i.e., the bombings, the hijacking of the plane and running and attacking the buildings with these hijacked planes. So the association of these particular technologies with the form of the 9/11 attacks, through their introduction for use at airports and borders, where new security measures have become routine, such as the removal of shoes, the patting down of bellies by security personnel, constitute the Muslim traveler, immigrant, and those who look like Muslims as potential suicide bombers in the public imagination. The figure of the Muslim outsider, whether a legal citizen or not, is recast by such surveillance techniques into the archetype of the current global menace in the Western imagination, the suicide bomber. Decontextualizing and dehistoricizing the politics and actual practices of particular suicide bombers, these measures treat the bodies of all immigrants and refugees who look like Muslims as literal ticking bombs. Have these bodies of color then moved from a model of a qualified citizenship to the model of Guantanamo Bay as the most expedient form of governmentality in the interests of national security? In response to the new travel regulations discussed above, the Canadian government issued a travel advisory cautioning those among its citizens born in the listed countries against travel to the United States unless such travel was absolutely necessary. This measure was attacked by conservative politicians and commentators in Canada, and it angered many in the United States, including the Bush administration, prompting the right-wing talk show host Pat Buchanan to call Canada Soviet Kanakistan. Prime Minister Chrétien, of course, was lauded for having issued this travel advisory. And the move was actually, supported distinguishing liberal Canada from an ultra, conservative right-wing Bush administration. In this instance, the racial profiling, i.e. that people born in particular countries traveling into the United States, even if they had Canadian citizenship, were to be fingerprinted and photographed. These measures and this particular form of profiling clearly originated in U.S. border control policy, as the entry of travelers with origins in predominantly Muslim countries was to be subjected to intensified security measures. However, the Canadian government responded by issuing the travel advisory to Canadian citizens with origins in those countries, not to all Canadian citizens. Even though the Canadian response clearly sought to protect Canadian citizens born in these specified countries from such intrusive practices, in effect, it made the same racialized distinction between its citizens by not issuing the travel advisory to all Canadian citizens, but only to those with origins in predominantly Muslim countries. The racialized distinction among citizens originating in the United States was thereby unproblematically reproduced in Canada, with Muslim citizens being redefined by both the US and Canadian states as occupying a separate category of religious citizenship. The case of Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen of Syrian origin, presents yet another disturbing example of the current erosion of the citizenship rights of those who look like Muslims. While traveling back to Canada from a holiday in Tunisia, Mr. Arar was detained in New York on allegations of terrorism. Although traveling on a Canadian passport, he was subsequently deported to Syria, where he was detained for over a year and was allegedly tortured while held in custody. Following intense lobbying by his wife and supporters, Mr. Arar was released and returned to Canada. He has not been officially charged with any terrorist or other criminal offenses. As most of you will be aware, there is an inquiry going on into the Arar case. Although allegations have been made anonymously against him by law enforcement agents and were widely reported in the media. Having acquired Canadian citizenship and having lived most of his adult life in Canada, Mr. Arar's request to U.S. authorities to be sent back to Canada were ignored, and he was instead sent back to where he came from. This case demonstrates that allegations, and there are many, many other cases that I'm sure you can cite, I know of the campaigns that have been going on here in Montreal, demonstrate that allegations of links to terrorist organizations, no matter how flimsy the evidence, can be used by authorities to overturn the protections of Muslim citizens. The case demonstrates how caviarly the United States has claimed the unilateral power to decide whether the Canadian citizenships of Muslims, or indeed their citizenship in any other country, is to be upheld or whether it is to be abrogated. The U.S. is today asserting a globalized sovereignty so that it can override the citizenship rights proffered by other states to their citizens. The implications of the post-9/11 border control practices mean that the citizenship of Muslims in countries other than the United States is nevertheless to be subjected to U.S. power, whether those Muslims have sought U.S. citizenship or not. The allegation of terrorism, whether proven or not, is enough to abrogate the individual's right to have rights. I'm borrowing this phrase from Hannah Arendt. Citizenship within particular nation states was one of the means for the protection of the rights of individuals within the international system of law. People of color in this country struggled long and hard for access to citizenship rights. With all its limitations, such protection is today being taken away from Muslim citizens. simply on the basis of their religious identity. So what have been some of the feminist responses to the current situation as we find ourselves in it? The formulation of the war on terror has repeatedly presented it as a defense of the West and its values, as well as a liberatory project for Muslim women. Women have often been in the lead in mobilizing support for the war on terror, presenting the Bush administration and its allies as quasi-feminist. The spouses of President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair took to actively campaigning for public support for the war, presenting it as the means to end the plight of Afghan women. The active participation of these prominent women and other women's rights activists and women's organizations have granted a legitimacy to the war that it would otherwise not have managed to acquire. As Sadef Arad Koch has said, images of victimized passive Muslim women and fanatically oppressive Muslim men have comforted parts of the public who would otherwise question the moral legitimacy of the world's strongest and wealthiest country waging a war against one of the poorest countries of the world, already devastated by more than 20 years of war. Where the leaders of the Taliban had defined the role of women as a key marker of their adherence to Islamic law, the Bush administration and the Canadian state has used the status of Afghan women under the Taliban regime as a major justification for the war on terrorism's first phase, the attack on Afghanistan, claiming to be working in the best interests of these women. Some feminist scholars, writers, and activists, Muslim and non-Muslim, have used various strategies to disrupt the hegemonic representation of Muslim women as homogeneous, as uniformly and universally victims. These strategies have included drawing attention to the colonialist and imperialist interests served by such constructs, reinterpreting key Islamic scriptures and practices from women-centered perspectives, contesting monolithic constructs of the Muslim woman by highlighting the diversity of the social status and political rights of women in different Muslim countries, contesting and reimagining foundational nationalist and religio-political narratives through various literary forms, highlighting the agency of Muslim women in subversively appropriating and redefining traditional roles and practices, foregrounding the secularist and modernist forces at work within Muslim societies and the role of women within these movements, and re-examining women's appropriation of contemporary gendered Islamist practices within the context of particular critiques of Eurocentric forms of modernity. None of these perspectives, strategies, critiques, which are readily available, are allowed to encroach into the public discussions of Muslim women and the war on terror. Indeed, many feminists have contributed to a deepening of the Orientalist constructs of Muslim women as victimized objects of oppression and of themselves as the active agents who will save these women. For example, media representations of feminists who have historically had limited access and little control over how they are represented themselves have followed a general trend. Those feminists who reproduce the exaltation of the West are granted space to air their views. Moderate Muslim women who are grateful to the West and extol its civilizational values, who contribute to the clash of civilization theses, if not actively supporting these theses, and who support the bid to rescue Afghan women from Afghan men, are given ample space in the public discourse that has been very much like that granted to anti-feminist feminists in the last decade of the 20th century. However, feminists who contest the pro-war discourse by raising the question of North-South power relations or who oppose U.S. and Canadian foreign policies are largely reviled and denigrated when given any coverage at all and personally attacked and reviled in their personal lives when they speak out publicly. Feminists who challenge the dominant pro-war discourse by raising the question of imperialism, of U.S. foreign policy, and Canada's collusion with U.S. foreign policy are represented as misguided and misinformed as best, and apologists for terrorism and fundamentalism at worst. So, what I want to say is that the casting of 9/11 as an attack not only on the United States, but as an attack on the entire West and its system of values, enabled the Bush administration to refashion a commonality of interests among those nations historically included in the project of the West. In Canada, this strategy has largely been successful thus far. Prior to the war in Afghanistan, opposition to the war on terror was construed as not only a refusal to support the U.S. and its foreign policies, but as an attack on the Canadian nation itself. Such opposition was also equated with support for terrorism as the Bush Doctrine gained wider legitimacy and international credibility. The acceptance of the Bush Doctrine, you are either with us or against them, found considerable support in Canada and continues to remain the frame within which the larger war on terrorism gets framed. Making the Bush Doctrine the appropriate frame for Canada's response to the war on terror, this strategy has furthered the defining of the Canadian nation-state as part of the community of the West. Given that some feminists have acquired a political currency and respectability by contributing to the gendered exaltation of the West, anti-imperialist feminism and anti-racist feminism, I want to argue, are crucial at this moment for feminists who want to respond in a way that is going to further women's liberation both in this country as well as in other parts of the world. As Sedef Arad Koch has noted, an unproblematized global sisterhood or global solidarity between women, which does not attend to the reality of imperialist power relations, has reproduced the discourse of us and them, which serves imperialist interests. Whether feminists are able to effectively develop anti-imperialist and anti-racist practices and how effectively we are able to do so will determine the possibility for alliances and solidarity among diverse groups of women in the age of the war on terrorism. Our struggle got a whole lot more difficult after 9/11, but it did not become impossible. Thank you.